It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. On this edition, Extension horticulturist Richard Giron and Extension entomologist Donald Lewis will answer your questions about the plants and insects in your life. Do carpenter ants seem to be coming out of your woodwork lately? You'll find out if they're pests or just tiny pals. Call in with your questions at 1-866-780-9100 or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. From bugs to buds, it's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa, and the conversation takes root just after the news. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Horticulture Day. I'm Julie Englander, and we're talking plants and insects as we're joined by Extension horticulturist Richard Giron and Extension entomologist Donald Lewis are here to answer your questions about the plants and bugs in your life. Call in with your questions at 1-866-780-9100. That's 1-866-780-9100. Or email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Good morning, Richard and Donald. How are you today?
Good morning.
Good morning. Doing fine.
Oh, good. Good. Let's start off with the carpenter ant situation. What is going on? People, I guess, may be seeing some come out of the woodwork. Are they seeing carpenter ants? And what do they look like compared to other ants?
Well, the really lucky people are those who are just seeing carpenter ants now for the first time that the weather has warmed up. Those people who saw carpenter ants through the winter, they have a much bigger problem than the rest of us. If you saw ants in the winter when it was cold outside, that meant they were your pals and you were growing them inside. No one calls them pals, by the way, Julia. When it gets to be warm outside, and especially when it's warm at night, like it turned back there earlier in the month of April, carpenter ants begin their feeding forages, and they go these long distances from their colonies looking for food. Carpenter ants live in wood, but they can't eat wood. So instead, they travel across the ground at night. They are scavengers. They pick up little bits of dead stuff that they find along the way, particularly hoping to find other dead insects that they will pick up and trundle back to the colony and carry with them, and then chop that up, that caterpillar, that beetle, that bug, whatever they found, and they'll feed that to the queen's offspring that are developing inside these colonies that may be located inside hollow trees, hollow limbs. They may be located in a dead stick of firewood. The worst situation is when the colony is located in your windowsill or in the 2x4s of your house. But when you have just one or two carpenter ants crawling through the house, especially here in the springtime, it frequently means they are accidental invaders. You ask how you're going to know if they're carpenter ants. Well, you pick them up to see if they're wearing their little tool bag with their hammers and saws. Actually, we do have to pick them up. You have to mush them as gently as possible. And when we look at these anywhere from half inch to 3/4 inch ants, we need to locate the thorax. That's the segment between the head and the abdomen. And on a carpenter ant, the thorax makes an even arch. It makes a very smooth, rounded arch from head to abdomen. If it's a different kind of ant, say if it's the kind of ant that's building the ant mounds out in your lawn, the arch from head to thorax, head to abdomen across the top of the thorax will have a notch in it. It will not be evenly rounded. This is probably easier to see. So if you Google carpenter ant identification, I'm sure you'll come up with some pictures of what we mean by this evenly rounded thorax. We have two really large black ants in Iowa, the carpenter ant that lives in rotten wood and the field ant that lives in the soil. And the difference is that notch in the field ant thorax that you see in profile when you look at them from the side.
Oh, okay. That's a good, very good description. And so as for some people may not see them as tiny pals. So is there a certain way to tell them not to come near the house?
No easy way. In fact, the easy solution of putting out ant bait never works for homeowners. Okay. And, you know, maybe it's worked once or twice for somebody somewhere, but almost invariably, if you as a homeowner buy a retail ant bait and put it out, it will not solve your carpenter ant problem. If you have a sufficient problem that it's worth hiring a pest control company to come treat for you, they do have effective ant baits that they can use around the outside of your house. And that, again, is where most of our carpenter ants are originating. And if you're going to do it yourself, give up on the baits and use the homeowner-style insecticides on the outside of the house, particularly across door thresholds, windowsills, putting up a little barrier to try to keep those wanderers from getting into your house overnight.
Okay, sounds good. We'll go to our callers now on Horticulture Day with Donald Lewis, entomologist, and Richard Giron, our horticulturist for today. Marilyn from Boone is on the line. Marilyn, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What's
your question?
I have
a problem in our ditch with a determined, small but determined expanse of pampas grass, and in our about 35-acre prairie, an increasingly growing Canadian thistle problem. And despite our efforts with the pampas grass to burn it or till it or round up it, it persists. And we are wanting to try to control the Canadian thistle growth without disturbing the forbs, and we're wondering the best way to handle both situations.
Well, what you're seeing in the ditch is probably some type or species of miscanthus. True pampas grass does not grow in central Iowa. It's not reliably hardy. But there is a species of miscanthus, fairly common in roadside ditches. The grass produces kind of a silvery white flower head in late summer. It's very distinctive, actually quite attractive. It is very hard to kill. I think it's going to take repeated efforts to destroy it, where you might use Roundup periodically over maybe a year or longer, or cultivation again where you do it repeatedly. But one application, one treatment per se is not going to do it. You have to be persistent and patient.
Okay, so we have done Roundup, but you would probably suggest that we do several Roundup sprays in a year then?
Right. So let's say you let the grass come up in the spring and grow a few inches tall, and then you apply the Roundup. And then I would expect the existing foliage to die back and possibly a part of the root system. But it's going to resprout, and then when it does, you hit it again with Roundup, and you keep on doing that repeatedly until basically it's gone.
Okay.
Or cultivating, where you go out there and cultivate it and keep on doing that until it's destroyed.
All right.
As far as the thistles in the pasture.
Well, this is a native prairie. It's been restored as a native prairie. So we just don't know what to do. They're really getting bad, and we've tried spot spraying and mowing. So
yeah, I think I would check with Bob Hartzler here at Iowa State.
How's that last name spelled?
H-A-R-T-Z-L-E-R.
Okay.
And Bob is the weed scientist at Iowa State, and he typically deals with weed control in field crops like corn and soybeans and pastures. And so the prairie is kind of in the pasture area.
All right.
So I would check with him. The phone number for Agronomy Extension here at Iowa State is 515-294-1923.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for calling. We appreciate the call. We'll go next to Wayne in Des Moines. Wayne, welcome to Horticulture Day. What's your question?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have four trees, for lack of a better word, that I have in big pots and I put outside in the summer and take inside in the winter. And they are outgrowing my house. And if there would be a way to find someone or some place that would take them and care for them rather than throw them out, I would be happy to give them away. And I'm wondering, how do I go about finding someone?
Well, you might just call around, maybe the local church, library, maybe some other public office building might want them.
Des Moines Botanical Center might have contacts that they would consider for this. I can tell you, as the assistant plant manager at a faith institution, that's what we're supposed to call church, by the way, Richard, our faith institution, we inherit a lot of overgrown plants, so that's a fairly common thing. The internet has a free exchange. One of them is called FreeCycle, One of them's called Craigslist. You could try listing them online at the places that exchange for free.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But you've hit a pretty common problem. It happens to all of us that are lucky enough to have at least a slightly green thumb to keep these things alive.
Now, do you think that these are relatively, I think, unique species?
Well, that would be the key as far as a botanic garden or someplace like that, because they probably already have a lot of different things, and they probably only have so much space. And so it has to be something unique for, like, a botanic garden or someplace of that type.
Okay.
That's where maybe the library, some other location, might be more willing to accept it.
Okay.
Thanks.
All right.
Good luck, Wayne. We hope you have one of those choices works out for you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. We'll go next to Marcy in Pleasant Hill. Marcy, welcome to the program. What's your question?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I hope you can help me with some persistent wasps. No matter what we do every year to spray or knock down nests, every spring they come back to the same spot and rebuild. So I'm hoping you can give some suggestions about how to rid our house of those.
What do they rebuild?
Those little hanging down, I don't know what you call them, the nest kinds of things, or whatever those are.
Up under the eaves of the house or in the porch, upside down hanging umbrella-like thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. These are called paper wasps. If it helps at all, they are beneficial. They feed on other insects, and so if you had a vegetable garden, they would be out there scouring the broccoli plants looking for cabbage worms to collect and take home and feed to the queen's offspring. They are moderately aggressive because they are a social wasp. They are going to defend their colony from all types of intruders, including you.
Okay.
And I think you have hit it. That you just have to start early and you have to be as persistent as they are in treating those nests. If you can reach them at night with one of the wasp and hornet aerosol sprays, that's an easy way to treat them because you don't have to get very close. But start early, treat often. If you, it's not practical to relocate them. And the only thing that's working in their favor here is it's just an ideal location. It's not a pheromone or something that's drawing them back. They're not like salmon returning to their spawning grounds. They are just going back to a place where it's great to nest because of the protection that's there. So knock the nests down early and keep at it.
Well, it's curious to hear that they're beneficial because of the sting made my husband get. We had to take him.
Well, be careful, Marcy. Yeah, but good luck with it. We're going to take a break here. And we appreciate the call. You're listening to Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. We'll be back in a few moments, or just a moment, actually, with Richard Giron and Donald Lewis. Call in at 1-866-780-9100. We'll be back in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Horticulture Day. I'm Julie Englander, and Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron and Extension Entomologist Donald Lewis are here to answer your questions about the plants you want to grow in or grow better and the insects that befriend or bedevil you. Call in at 1-866-780-9100 or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We do have an email from Ryan in Galesburg. He says, I planted a number of small Norway spruces in the timber last spring. Some of them were under the drip line of black walnuts. So juglone, is that right? Toxicity may be affecting them. He wants to know the signs of them. Is that the correct way of pronouncing
that?
Well,
I think there's a number of things going on there that if it is within the drip line of a large tree like a walnut, there's a lot of shading going on. They're not getting enough sun. I think that's probably the bigger concern. They're not getting enough sun. Then you have the competition for water and nutrients between the two trees. And my guess is the big tree is winning out. And then you have the juglone produced by the walnut tree, which tends to inhibit a nearby plant's growth. So you combine all those factors, and you're creating an environment that's very unfavorable for the spruce trees. So my suggestion would be to remove them or transplant them to a different site where they are in the full sun, where they're away from any big tree, where they can grow to their full potential.
Okay. We'll go to Nick in Ames, who's on the line. Welcome to Talk of Iowa Horticulture Day. Nick, what's your question?
Hi.
Hi.
We have some decades-old tulips, this lovely purple and copper color. And we're concerned about them dying eventually and wondering if there's a safe way to propagate them.
There really isn't, not in our area, because in our climate, they tend to go downhill. They get weaker and weaker. And so we don't have the climate like Holland where they can actually produce these in mass. We just don't have the right growing conditions. So the best that we can do is keep them as long as possible, which means snapping off the flower head as soon as they're done blooming so they don't form that seed pod, and then allow the foliage to die back naturally. If we do those two things, we can enjoy them as long as possible.
So you can't collect the seeds and...
No, we just don't have the right growing conditions to do that. And even if you did, they wouldn't produce the same plant most likely. Most of the varieties that you buy are cultivars, and they don't reproduce true from seed in most cases. Species tulips do, but not the modern hybrids.
Well, these are, I think, are at least 50 or 60 years old. Mm-hmm. I mean... How long could tulips keep going?
They've been breeding tulips for many, many years. They had the tulip craze back in, I think, the 17th century, 18th century, whatever, in Holland. So they've been doing this for a long, long time. But if you've had them for 40, 50 years, then apparently you have a type or variety that may persist for another 10 or 15 years. So I would just give them good care and see what they do.
Well, thanks a lot.
Thanks for calling, Nick.
Bye-bye.
Appreciate the call. Bye-bye. But you should not cut back the leaves on the tulips. Is that right? You should let them die back naturally.
So. Right, because when they're actually blooming, the stored food in the bulb has been used up to produce the foliage and the flower. And so after blooming, there's like a 4, 5, 6 week period where the foliage still remains, and that foliage is manufacturing food. Mm. And most of the food manufactured by the foliage moves down into the bulb. So by the time they die back, they have a nice full food reserves in the bulb. If you allow the seed pod to form, then most of that energy gets diverted to the seed pod and very little to the actual bulb, and that's why they tend to weaken very quickly. So pick off the actual flower head and allow the foliage to die back naturally.
Okay. We'll go next to Bill in Sac City. Bill, welcome to Talk of Iowa Horticulture Day. What's your question?
Oh, good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
It's more of a comment, and this is a comment relating to the lady that had called in regarding the Canadian thistles in her prairie with a lot of forbs or flowers. And I've been dealing with prairies for probably about 25 years, and Canadian thistles are just a common visitor. If I have a small area that's infested with Canadian thistles, I just use a backpack sprayer and use a chemical like Milestone or Transline and just spray the individual plants, you know, trying to knock them back. And it may take a couple of different treatments, usually spring or fall or both. And then secondly, if it's a large area, probably the best combination that I found that works is a combination of burning and mowing, and you just keep starving the plants out. The combination of burning and prairie burning in the spring or fall, and then knocking them back with mowing during the later season. Eventually, the prairie plants win, but the key word here is patience. It's not going to be one or two trips, probably over a couple of year period of time, but the prairie plants eventually will outcompete the thistles.
Okay.
Nice to know there are no easy answers.
There are no easy answers with that, and it is a tough weed, trust me. Plus, it grows by rhizomes, and so I would say once you treat some of the little brothers and sisters, they're or the uncles and aunts, the brothers and sisters and the cousins, they show up down the line a little bit later. So it's an ongoing process.
Well, thanks for the information, Bill. We appreciate it.
You bet. Bye.
Bye-bye now. We'll go next to Eric in Viola, Illinois. Welcome to Talk of Iowa Horticulture Day. Eric, what's your question?
Thanks. I also have a follow-up comment on the person with the native prairie restoration. The concern about the miscanthus coming in. And I really appreciate this show that Extension puts on, and I really wish that there was a little more emphasis on some of the natives, because one of the things, I work in the Quad City area, spend a lot of time volunteering and a lot of time in my own work with prairie restoration and protecting remnant prairies, and species such as miscanthus are proving to be a real concern, and especially when I'm hearing discussion about cellulosic ethanol coming in and people wanting to plant, you know, 30, 50, hundreds of acres of miscanthus, that is really hard on wetlands, on prairie remnants. I had a landowner who's got this.
Well, you want to weigh in on that, Richard?
Well, there are many species of miscanthus, and not all are invasive. So there are some very nice ornamental types. There are some that are invasive, but not all miscanthus are bad. So,
Okay.
One last follow-up is so many of the invasive plants that we deal with, whether it's in our forests or in our prairies, are very often from the nursery industry.
Mm.
And it's just a concern. I think there are a lot of good natives out there that we can look at. It's just they're not as popular. So,
Eric left. He made some good points.
And as Bill Boone taught us decades ago, go native. there's a lot of good native plants that we can incorporate in our home landscapes with a little effort and understanding.
Okay. Well, we appreciated that call and getting that information from Eric. We'll go next to Lisa in Janesville. We're becoming up on a break pretty soon. Lisa, you have any short question?
I have some windows that are casement windows from my house that had seal failures in them that I've replaced over. They range from 5 to 12 years old, and I've been saving them thinking of somehow incorporating them into a home-built greenhouse or something of that nature. Is the fact that they're UV-coated and that they have seal failures in them going to make them less effective in that, to use them for that?
Wow, the UV coating is a bit of a concern as Richard and I sit here scratching our heads consecutively on this one. The seals are really not such an issue for a greenhouse where you're just trying to let in a lot of light and keep the heat level high. So
right.
If you can join them together, I think is my biggest issue. My biggest concern is how are you going to join these windows together to make something that's going to hold up to snow and wind and rain?
Right. I have no idea. It's just been a pipe dream, and I just thought, if I was wasting my time, I'd find some other way to dispose of them. But, trying to reuse something that, instead of throwing it in the landfill, it was just a thought.
Yeah, I'm all for it. I would contact the window manufacturer myself and say, this UV protection, has it broken down after the 12 to 15 years? How much of it is still there? And how good was it really in the spectrum of light that is necessary for plant growth? I think that's a pretty technical question that we're going to have help from a manufacturer or a UV coating specialist to have better information than we have right here at the moment.
Okay.
Thanks, Lisa.
Thank you.
Good luck. We appreciate the call. We're going to take a 5-minute break, but when we return, Horticulture Day continues with Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron and Extension Entomologist Donald Lewis. They'll be here to answer your questions about the plants and bugs in your life. 1-866-780-9100 or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We'll be back in a few minutes.
Time is running out for energy efficiency tax credits. This is the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. You can just about bet on it. Energy prices are going to keep going up. If you've been thinking about making your house more energy efficient, right now is a pretty good time. That's because a federal tax credit will be running out in just a few months. Rebecca Williams has more on that.
Pete Sickman Garner didn't have any trouble finding the leaks in his house. It was built in the 1940s with pretty much zero insulation.
It was cold. I mean, my daughter, there were nights when she woke up because she had rolled over and she was leaning against the wall, and it was so cold it woke her up.
And there were those huge gas and electric bills in the dead of winter. He says he and his wife knew they really had to seal up the house. So they hired a guy to blow insulation into the walls, and they put up new storm windows.
It was roughly a $4,000 home improvement, so not insignificant. But so far, we've gotten back $900 on our gas bill. It should pay for itself easily within 5 years.
And on top of that, they got a tax credit. There was a pretty huge tax incentive last year for making your home more energy efficient. And it's happening again this year. But it's winding down. You only have 8 months left. The government will essentially pay you to make your house more efficient. You can get a tax credit for 30% up to $1,500 total for all of your purchases. But these home energy tax credits can get complicated. Insulation and air conditioners and windows have to meet certain codes. You can't go by the Energy Star label alone. On top of that, you can include the cost of installing heating and cooling equipment in your tax credit, but you can't include those installation costs for anything else. Ronnie Queller is with the Alliance to Save Energy.
Ask the retailer, do these items qualify for the federal tax credits?
Queller says the best place to start is to make sure you have enough insulation for your climate, and then seal up the little leaks in your house. You could pay $300 to $500 for an energy audit, or you can try this trick. Close all the windows and doors, turn on your kitchen and bathroom exhaust fans, and then
light, say, a stick of incense and just walk around the perimeter of your house on the inside, holding the incense around the edges of the windows and the doors. And if you see the smoke blowing in towards you, whether or not you can actually feel air coming in, you'll know that there is some air leak.
She says sealing up those leaks can save you as much as 20% on your energy bills. And a lot of the little and big things you do can count toward your $1,500 tax credit. The thing is, most people tend to think about their taxes at the end of the year. Unfortunately for some businesses, that means they're slammed when the weather's the worst. Donna Napolitano runs Mechanical Energy Systems. They sell all kinds of high-efficiency heating and cooling equipment. She says people were squeaking in their big purchases right up until December last year.
It was crazy here. We were installing every day, and we had to combat against the weather. I mean, hello, summer is here, and it's a great time to put systems in now.
Unless this tax credit gets extended, you only have a few more months. Everything has to be paid for and installed by December 31st. So if you're a procrastinator, you might want to start thinking about your projects sometime soon.
By the way, if you want to do those extremely efficient installations like solar panels and geothermal heating and cooling systems, that 30% tax credit is not capped at $1,500, and it does not run out this year. That's the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham.
Support comes from the Park Foundation, the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation, and the Great Lakes Fishery Trust. You can find more information and post your comments at environmentreport.org. The Environment Report comes from the University of Michigan.
This is Talk of Iowa. It's Horticulture Day. I'm Julie Englander. Extension horticulturist Richard Giron and extension entomologist Donald Lewis are here to answer your questions about plants and insects. Call in at 1-866-780-9100 or email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we'll go right to the phones to Kathy, who's in Ackley, Iowa. Welcome, Kathy, to the program. Thanks for waiting.
Thank you.
What's your question?
I have an interest in a Japanese red maple, but I think we're right on the cusp between zones 4 and zones 5. Do you think I'd have success with a Japanese maple?
I really don't think you will, no.
Why do they sell them in our local store?
Well, people want to try. That's why we know it doesn't always work.
They even have a struggle here in Ames.
Really?
We have some on campus. The ones on campus survive. They don't really thrive. They're not very good-looking specimens. And if we have a really cold winter, they oftentimes suffer fairly extensive dieback. So unless you have an extremely protected site, then I would probably say no.
We have them in courtyards on campus where there's not much wind, where they're sheltered all the time, and they just sort of sit there. They're alive, but that's all you can say.
When they thrive, they're a beautiful tree.
Yes, they are.
Yeah,
so if you lived in southeast Iowa, Fairfield, Keokuk, Burlington, most likely you could.
Okay.
But as you go farther north, it becomes more and more of a problem as far as hardiness.
All right.
Sorry about that, Kathy. Thanks for calling, though.
Hey, can I have one more question?
Sure.
My hostas are plagued with slugs. Is there an easy or some surefire way to get rid of slugs? I know we're going to have them all because we burn wood, and I know that wood pile generates them, but
As with many things, easy, probably not.
That's right. This so far today, we have struck out with an easy solution for miscanthus grass. We don't have an easy solution for Canadian
surefire,
thistles.
Surefire. I'll go with surefire.
We don't have a surefire answer for the guy's tulip propagation. We didn't help the woman very much who wanted to use her UV windows. Start early, treat often is the answer to slugs. Do not wait till you come home from the state fair to start your program. In fact, you should have your first slug bait down by Memorial Day weekend.
Okay, great. I can do that.
And whether it's the metaldehyde slug bait that you use very sparingly or if it's the iron phosphate bait that you use sparingly because you paid so much for it, use it with care. Sprinkle it lightly. Don't pile it up. The slugs aren't going to play King of the Mountain to get up on top and eat the bait. So scatter it lightly and get started early with it.
Thanks.
All right.
Good luck, Kathy. Thank you.
Bye.
We appreciate it. We'll go next to Gary in Cedar Rapids. So welcome to the program, Gary. What's your question?
Hi, Julie. I was just wondering if there is a treatment that can be done to yards that make it, you know, kill the weeds and make it look good and be eco-friendly to the worms and the other insects that are, you know, that need to be there.
Well,
I understand that, like, True Value or True Green and some of those commercial ones are really not the best for your lawn. I've always heard that.
Well,
I don't know if that was true or not.
Well, there's two types of herbicide that we commonly use. One is a pre-emergent. We put that on in the spring. And that basically prevents the germination of crabgrass seed and some other weed seed.
Uh-huh.
And as far as our pre-emergent, we do have choices. We do have chemical materials, but we also have corn gluten meal, which is an organic material. So we have a choice in that regard as far as a pre-emergent. As far as controlling existing weeds, things like dandelion, plantain, clover,
yeah.
Basically, for those, we're going to have to use a broadleaf herbicide, which is a chemical.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's necessary, then it's best to try to maximize the benefit. And the best time to apply a broadleaf herbicide is in the fall, sometime between mid-September and November 1. And if you do so at that time, you should get the maximum control possible. Spring applications are not as effective as fall applications. So if you have to do something, you want to maximize the benefit. And so fall applications typically are the best.
No, I didn't know that. They're very good. Where would you find some of those applications at?
Well, you can find broadleaf herbicides at most garden centers. And in this case, you'd want to use a spray. You don't want to use the weed and feed products.
Uh-huh.
You'd want to use a spray because when you use a spray, you can spot treat. You don't have to treat the whole yard. You can just spot treat those areas that you need to. So you don't have to do the whole yard. If you use a weed and feed, you probably should do the whole yard because you're putting on fertilizer at the same time.
And find a way to measure the exact right amount of herbicide in a gallon of water so that you're not over-applying. More is not better. And we're pretty lucky to have products that have gone through rigorous testing, and the environmental impacts are much less with the current products, the modern products, than they were, say, 20 to 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And the other thing is to give the lawn good care. If you have a nice, healthy, thick lawn, you're going to have fewer weeds in that yard because there's fewer opportunities. So that means mowing properly, mowing around 2.5 to 3 inches, mowing often, not scalping the lawn, that type of thing. If you need to maybe overseed in late summer, early fall, that type of thing where you have a nice thick lawn where you don't have that many weeds and where you don't have to spray that often.
Yeah, great. Hey, thanks very much.
Thanks for calling, Gary.
You bet.
Good
bye-bye.
Call. Yeah, bye-bye. Catherine from Marion wanted to know about getting rid of dandelions now, but you're saying that should have been done in the fall or wait until the fall?
Well, fall is the best time to do it. Right now, they're most noticeable. They're blooming. They're out there. You can see them. And you have this urge to kill them now, basically, because you can see them.
Right.
But they only bloom for a few weeks, and then they persist. But they're not as noticeable. They're just a green plant. So I would probably be inclined just to kind of ignore them as best you can. Keep the lawn well mowed so they look okay. The lawn looks okay. And then take care of them in the fall.
Okay.
Fall works best in that in the fall of the year, the plants are getting ready for winter. These perennial plants, these perennial weeds are getting ready for winter. And so the foliage is manufacturing food and sending that food down into the taproot of the dandelion plant. And so you have this downward flow in the plant. So if you apply a broadleaf herbicide, the foliage absorbs that material, and then it moves down along with the food down into the actual taproot, destroying it, so it's basically dead. In the spring of the year, you have the exact opposite, where you have food being sent up from the taproot to produce the foliage and the flowers, and so you have this upward movement, and so it's not quite as effective in the spring.
Okay.
But we have good soil moisture right now, mm-hmm. and while they are obvious in blooming, digging is an option, but dig as deeply as you can with one of those weed poker things to get as much of that taproot out of the ground as possible. But they come up real easily right now because the soil has good moisture.
Okay. We'll go next to Everett in Cedar Rapids. Everett, welcome to Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. What's
good
your
morning.
Question? Hi.
Yeah. Thank you for being there. Well, I appreciate it today. I have railroad ties that I made into a garden here several years ago, about 25 years ago, matter of fact. And one of them is really deteriorated, and I want to get rid of it. And I don't want to go through railroad ties again. Number one, it's too much work. And number two, some plants just don't seem to grow on that creosote very well.
Mm-hmm.
What can I replace that with besides regular pine that termites will get into?
You could try some of the concrete block and brick that they use to make retaining walls. You could use that to make a raised bed very easily.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And those stack up, and you can buy pieces that are easy enough to carry as opposed to a railroad tie that is very, very heavy.
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
Treated landscape timbers
yeah.
Contain a wood preservative, and if you buy cheap ones, you get lots of pine lumber and very little preservative, so you may have to shop around to find some that are very well treated to resist decay,
yeah.
which is the first problem, and the treatments also resist carpenter ant and termite invasion.
Because my neighbor has some he got from Menards, and he's got 2x10s, and they're treated. And they've probably been there, oh, I suppose 10 years, and I mean, nothing has happened, no deterioration at all.
Yeah.
I guess I was kind of thinking about something like that. See, I've got 4 beds, and they're 17 feet long, but they're 18. And I just don't want to have to mess with those railroad ties again.
No, I don't blame you. Having sold those when I was in college and loading those up into people's cars to carry home.
Yeah, and we've got strawberries in one bed, and they just don't seem to run. And I've had them in there once before, and they just don't seem to run very well. Get them into my regular bed that doesn't have a raised bed, and then they'll do okay. So I wonder if part of the creosote here is if that's part of why the strawberries aren't running right.
I would guess probably not.
No.
But I don't think I would use those again.
No.
I would definitely look at the concrete blocks and bricks because they're not going to break down at all. They're not going to rot. And they're easily attainable. So.
Yes.
Thanks, Everett. We appreciate the call.
Right.
Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye now. We'll go next to Linda in Waverly. Welcome to Horticulture Day. Linda, what's your question for Richard and Donald?
Hi.
Hi.
My house is going to FEMA after the flood, and finally. And I have some tulips and bulbs that are, of course, blooming right now. And I have some other little ground cover things. And I'm wondering, is there any way I can pull up those things while they're blooming? Because I don't know if I wait till after I close, if I can legally go back and grab them.
Yeah, this is always a problem, isn't it, Richard? There's a best time to do something, but there's a deadline sometimes.
Right. As far as perennial plants, things like phlox and peonies and things like that, it's not the best time to be doing it right now, but if you can get in there and dig them up with a nice ball of dirt around the root system, and give them good care once you replant those, they'll probably be okay. So if you can do that, you can probably save them. On things like tulips and daffodils and the spring flowering bulbs, transplanting them right now would be very, very hard to do. They really need to go ahead and die back naturally. At that point, you could dig them up, and you can move those bulbs fairly easily. But trying to move them when they're actually green and blooming, they're very fragile, especially the tulips, and they tend to break very easily. So you might have to sacrifice some plants, possibly, maybe not move everything, and concentrate on those that you can move, and just dig them up with a nice ball of dirt and move them to the new site.
Okay. Do you think after they tear my house down, you know, it's going to be green space? My biggest concern is that they would just get destroyed. But maybe when they tear that house down, do you think maybe those might be able to survive and come, I mean, or will they probably get destroyed when they tear the house down?
I wouldn't count on those surviving. They'll probably push dirt around and things like that. I don't think you can count on that, no.
Bulldozers and excavators just don't treat plants very kindly.
And then one quick question about my new place. I'm thinking about, instead of having a lawn, because I hate mowing the lawn, that I might just have, actually I thought, well, violets get in your lawn anyway. Maybe I'll just have a lawn of violets or some kind of ground cover that I wouldn't ever have to mow. Is that feasible to do?
You can create some very large flower beds where you have various plants, perennials in those beds, and you can use mulching quite heavily if you'd like. So you can reduce the amount of grass, but it's always nice to have some grass, especially if you have children to play in the grass. It's kind of nice to have that.
Little paths between it.
Right.
You may have to check with the city ordinances to find out what it says about nuisance properties. That if it looks too unmaintained, the neighbors may complain, and you may have height restrictions on what you're allowed to grow that's not mowed. So
yeah.
We run into that where people say, well, I'm just going to turn my front yard into a prairie. And sometimes there are restrictions against the height of plants that can be in that situation. So check around.
All right. Yeah, I want it to be pretty, but the grass thing is a good thing because I'm going to be a grandma here in June finally. So maybe. Oh. All right. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Linda. Congratulations. Yeah.
All right.
Good
Bye.
Luck. Bye-bye now. We appreciate the call. We've got an email from Christopher. He asks, can you please tell me how to grow or propagate Indian paintbrush? He says he lives in Iowa City.
Oh, I don't know offhand. I would have to check some references on that. I don't know offhand.
Okay. We'll go next to Kurt in Dubuque. Kurt, welcome to Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. What's your question?
Yeah, I thought I'd give you another opportunity to feel inadequate.
Oh, thanks.
Trumpeter vine. We planted it to grow on a trellis that was, we thought, self-contained in an area, and the trumpeter vine has decided that our efforts to contain it ought to be thwarted.
Mm-hmm.
We'd like to kill it, but we're being told that that's like nearly impossible. So is there a fail-safe, foolproof way to kill this without hurting other things?
Well, the trumpet vine actually has some very attractive flowers. They're typically orange or reddish. It is a woody vine, but the bad thing about the trumpet vine is it sends up shoots or suckers from its root system, so they sprout everywhere near the parent plant.
Including on your neighbor's property.
Yes, right. They can do that. They don't know boundary lines, so that's no problem. As far as controlling them, it is very hard. It's going to, again, take some patience and persistence. And what I would probably suggest is that you cut the plants down, maybe leave maybe a foot or so above ground as far as the shoots, and cut them down, and then immediately take Roundup, the concentrate, and apply it directly to the cut surface. And you can use like a foam-type paintbrush or something of that order and apply it directly to the cut surface. Now, hopefully what that's going to do is it may destroy a part of the root system, just a part, though. And so undoubtedly, in a few weeks, you'll see other sprouts coming up. And when they come up, you're going to do the same thing. And you're going to keep on doing this repeatedly over time. It may take a year, possibly two. So it is a long-term project. But that's about the only way that I know of really to get rid of that. It does sucker, and it's a plant that doesn't want to give up. It wants to survive. It wants to grow. So,
not even a flamethrower, huh, Richard? I'm thinking buying a flamethrower.
No. You've got to control the root system, and the flamethrower is not going to get the root system.
Yeah,
so.
It sure sounded like fun to me, though. We've hit the trifecta: miscanthus, Canada thistle, and now trumpet vine. What a big day it's been for us.
Thanks for the call, Kurt.
Thank you.
No, I appreciate it. Good luck with that. We'll see what happens, I guess. You're listening to Talk of Iowa Horticulture Day with Richard Giron and Donald Lewis. Insects and bugs today, 1-866-780-9100, or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We'll go next to Pete in Cedar Rapids. Pete, welcome to the program. Thanks for waiting.
Thank you, Julie.
Hi.
I have a quick comment and then a quick question, please. The comment is there's a mechanical way to get dandelions up, which works real well, I think, easier than getting on your knees and using one of those little spade things. It's called the Weed Hound.
Oh, yeah.
And Target had it, and Menards has a knockoff, and I've used it very effectively, and I don't have to put anything down, and you have to do a little work, carry a bucket, but you're not bending and stooping.
Uh-huh.
Okay. It's about $20, and they have a lifetime guarantee. One of mine, a well broke, and they just mailed me another one. I sent them a email. They sent me another one, no questions asked.
Cool.
Yeah, that was cool. Now, my question, please, is a landscaper supplier told me that when I buy mill organite and spread it on the lawn, that I'm not going to get any results under or around trees because the trees slurp up the fertilizer, and I wondered if that's really the story. Do they do that, or...
Well, that would be true for any fertilizer. When you fertilize the yard, and if you have trees and shrubs in the yard, the tree roots will absorb some of that, but the grass will get some too.
Okay.
So it's being divided. My guess is that the tree roots will get most of it, but the grass will get some of it. And so that's just reality. You have the competition. It's there, and both plants will seek it out and get some of it. So, yeah, when you actually fertilize the lawn, you're indirectly fertilizing your trees and shrubs, too, at the same time.
That's not a problem for me, but he was just telling me that I'm wasting my money by doing it around the tree. And I'm thinking, how can a tree have its roots all the way up to the surface of the soil?
Actually, the tree roots are very shallow. The vast majority are on the upper 1 foot of soil.
Oh, I didn't know that.
They're very shallow. They're very extensive. They go out a tremendous distance from the trunk of the tree. Mm-hmm. So on the average yard, I'm guessing tree roots are most areas in the yard, in most average lawns. And they're there because that's where the nutrients are as far as the topsoil.
Okay.
But the tree roots also have to breathe. They have to respire. And there's a little bit of air space in the upper foot or so of soil, and that's why they're there.
Okay. So the guy was basically telling me correctly.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I got to help out that grass because
you fertilize the yard and you realize, yeah, I'm going to fertilize the yard and the tree roots will get some and the grass will get some. Everything's happy.
Okay.
Thanks, Pete.
Thanks.
We appreciate the call. Well, we started with ants and we might end up with them. Donald, we have a question, an email. We have two large ant mounds in our backyard. Each is around 18 inches in diameter and are raised up higher than the grass. Would you recommend spraying them?
Oh, spraying could be done. The ants are going to persist no matter what we do, so we'll add this to the list of miscanthus and Canada thistle that trumpet vine, you're just going to have to keep at it. I actually find it easier to use granules on those ant mounds, and we love ants. They're beneficial. They're doing all kinds of good things for us in terms of aerating the soil, stirring the soil, but when they persist so vigorously in one small area that the ant mound gets taller than the grass, then they need to be beat back a little bit. And spreading insecticide granules on that works well for me, and then rake it in. I also try to rake that soil around to lower the mound down a little bit. Spraying with an insecticide could be done. I just think most of the insecticide spray is going to stick to the soil particles and less of it will be available for controlling the ants. My experience is one treatment never solves the problem, and I just have to keep going back and retreating those areas that are prime ant digging locations.
Okay. Well, we are another day of horticulture is done, but we'll be back next week. Thanks very much to entomologist Donald Lewis and extension horticulturist Richard Giron. The Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our assistant producer today, Christina Sarnelli. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Thanks to everybody who called in this week. We'll be back next time on Friday. I'm Julie Englander. Thanks for joining us. We'll be right back.